You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. November is Native American Heritage Month, first enacted in 1990 to pay tribute to the ancestry and culture of this nation's indigenous people. But one of the essential pillars of Native American culture is under threat of fading from existence, their languages. According to Ethnologue, a resource on world languages, 98% of indigenous languages in the United States are considered endangered. And a United Nations report suggests that California could lose all of its American Indian languages if serious efforts aren't taken to preserve them. One of the groups behind that effort is the Advocates for Indigenous California Language Survival, an organization striving to restore and revive these languages so they may survive as an everlasting piece of indigenous culture in the state. Joining us now is Carly Tex, the advocacy group's executive director. Carly, welcome to Insight.
Good morning.
Good morning. Tell us more about your organization and its efforts to preserve indigenous languages throughout the state.
Sure. Yes. With the Advocates for Indigenous California Language Survival, which I'll refer to as the Advocates throughout this, we're a statewide nonprofit, and we were established, I believe, in 1992. So this is our 30th year, and we have a statewide reach, and it's very diverse, and we work with a variety of communities. Just in California alone, I believe there are 112 recognized tribes and about 81 seeking recognition, and they have a variety of different protocols and guidelines, and we try to work with them as much as possible to empower those communities to do language work on their own. So, just to give you an idea of how many languages exist in California, I believe there was California prior to contact was home to about 90 languages and about 45 different families, language families prior to contact. Now there are about half of those. And so the programs that we run are designed to meet the needs of those different communities. So our core program, probably our biggest and oldest program, is the Master Apprentice Program or Apprenticeship. And that one began in 1992 as an idea of Julian Lang, who is an artist who presides on our board now, and Leanne Hinton. And it was a model that pairs a highly motivated individual apprentice with a highly motivated and very patient speaker of the language. And the speaker mentors the apprentice and then helps them to acquire the language. And usually, but not always, that speaker is an elder. And although we are noticing that the speakers are getting younger and younger these days. Yeah. So through that program, teams of two are accepted and they work with us and they receive a grant to accomplish a number of hours working together, immersed in the language. And what the organization just provides is training on immersion methods to help them stay in the language and to not break into English and to help them find practical ways to incorporate language into their daily lives. And if this sounds interesting to anyone that's listening, that the program application is online and we don't pair the apprentices and masters together, but they have to find each other and commit to working with each other. And the more successful teams are the ones that live together or are near each other where they can work together daily. And through this program, the apprentices are to come out as speakers and users of the language more so than really good readers and writers of the language. So the emphasis is on speaking. But that model that the Advocates started took off and has been emulated nationally and internationally. And we've even given training in Canada and Australia to apprenticeship teams there. And we actually just gave training last week to a local tribe in California, the Washoe, where they have five teams. And the idea is that the five apprentices working with those elder speakers are going to in time take five more apprentices under their wing, and then the language grows from there. And right now we're supporting about 14 language teams of various different languages.
Wow, that there are so many moving parts to this, and like the operative words are like the commitment and the patience, right? You know, to learn a language. And you have this experience as well. Like your interest in tribal languages began as a teenager with your grandmother and other elders in, I believe, Western Mono County or the Western Mono community. I would imagine those early lessons in your youth, they resonate with you and obviously your work today that you're doing.
Yeah, it does. My language work is rooted in some core memories of working with my grandmother, because I'm not only into language, but I'm also a basket weaver, and so that was how she and I would work together on baskets together, and we would go gather basket sticks, and in the middle of our basket making, I would ask her how to say different words, and so she would teach me them, and I would write them down, and I still have those journals, and so it stemmed from there. And what I noticed is I know that we had some materials that anthropologists or linguists had come through the community, and they had gathered language materials and then made a dictionary. And unfortunately, when we pulled out the dictionary to help grandma refresh her memory, we were unable to read it. And so that's where kind of that spark came for me of I really would like to get into a field where I can help, you know, our people understand these materials. So that led me into the field of linguistics. And so that actually led me to working with the advocates, because I became connected with a program that they administered called the Breath of Life. And can I tell you a little bit about that program?
Oh yeah,
too?
Please do. Yeah, the Breath of Life.
Yeah. Yes. So I actually went to the Breath of Life, and I think the Breath of Life began. I might be fudging the date a little bit, but I think it began in 1995, and it was co-founded by Leanne Hinton and L. Frank Manriquez, and is now administered by the Advocates in partnership with UC Berkeley. And that was in response to communities that actually don't have access to a speaker, and their speakers maybe all gone, mm-hmm. Or they might remember some of the language, but those communities have archive materials in the university. And the university has a wealth of materials because back in California's young history, researchers went to these different communities and gathered as much information as they could about the languages and cultures, because we were a dying people. We weren't expected to be here by now. And so those materials are archived. And so what the advocates offer is an opportunity for community researchers to come to UC Berkeley and access those archives. And then we actually help them get paired with a linguist and somebody who can help them take those materials and make sense of them, learn how to read the writing in them, learn how to put the sounds into words, and then to put the words into sentences. And it's a week-long institute. And at the end of it, they can walk away with copies of those archived materials and perhaps a project, and maybe planting a seed of a future language program. And we actually have people that have come through that program who are probably masters of their language and could be in the apprenticeship program too. So that's actually how I became connected with the advocates, because I was one of those partners. I worked with the group and helping them to research the materials and then to make sense of them. But that model also took off, and there's a national Breath of Life that took place at Washington, D.C. for a few years, and now it's administered by the Miamia Center at the University of Ohio. There's a BOL 2.0 that shows people what to do with the materials and how to create a digital archive. So that model has also taken off, and yeah, so that's how I got connected.
Yeah, there's so much going on, which is just so wonderful, because it's really piecing together languages that are seriously at risk of being lost. And as you said yourself, I mean, you were a dying people. You weren't expected to be here. And,
right.
And thankfully you are, despite all of those injustices that took place. You know, given that you have this this intimate and very personal experience with language, with your family and your elders. You know, we're also talking about, you know, the threat of native languages in California and just more broadly the United States in danger of extinction. I would imagine in your lifetime you've had a front row seat to the dwindling of languages.
Yes. Yes, and it just in my time of working with this organization, we have seen some of the last speakers of a language pass away. And fortunately, they were able to work with some apprentices to teach them the language and to have them become masters. That's why I say we've seen the masters getting younger and younger. And one thing we ask of the apprentices is, you know, to have patience with their master and to focus on speaking the language. And if it's possible that they record what they're doing with their master speaker. Mm-hmm. And we as an organization, we're not documenting and preserving the languages for them. And what we're trying to do is to provide the tools so they can do it themselves. So we have offered workshops on things like intellectual property. We have trainings with our apprenticeship teams and emphasize to them, this is some things to consider as you're recording. We offer small grants of up to $750 that goes to individuals or other grassroots organizations doing the work independently and they need some support. So for example, this year we've given funding for laptops so students can attend Zoom classes online for their languages if it's offered. Funding for conference travel, also just funding so they can purchase a recorder, and also get-togethers for communities so they can learn from a speaker or they can meet with a linguist and continue that work that they started at A Breath of Life, for example, and so they can understand their language's grammar. And we've also supported food for classes, voice recorders, just as long as it pertains to language reclamation work and it's of a California language, that's what we support.
Yeah, I mean, these resources are resources of empowerment, right? You know, you're empowering people to take it upon themselves to restore, you know, part of their identity and their generational identity. And, mm-hmm. you know, that is a threat of no longer existing. You know, given all of the resources that you just laid out, what currently are some of the biggest challenges that you face in preserving Indigenous languages in California?
So for the organization, I think the biggest challenge that we've had is this is the pandemic, because we recognize that there is some danger in having our get-togethers, and so much of our language work is done in person, like the apprenticeships, our gatherings. We put our biennial gatherings on hold, and we had to adapt to online spaces. And it's just so different from the original intent, I believe, of the work that, you know, you're working with each other one-on-one, and now we're forced to be in separate homes and working in online spaces. And some of our community members don't know how to access Zoom, or they don't know how to call into a teleconference. And so what we're looking at now is helping those communities to adapt and if they're a language teacher, perhaps having a workshop where we can help them to move their class to an online space or help them connect with apps that are useful for them, and just continuing to work through that. And so as we start to tiptoe back out into a normal world, we just had our summer institute this past summer at Berkeley, and we had to get together there. We had our Breath of Life.
That must have felt so nice after a couple of years of suspending in-person gatherings.
It was great for everybody to be back together. And we still had, you know, erred on the side of caution, because what's at the, you know, the center of this is protection of our elders, and their you know, they're who we go to for guidance, and then they're also the language keepers, and they've lived long lives and have a lot of experience. And it was just of utmost importance to us that we protect them as our master speakers.
You know,
So as we start to move to come out of it, it's what I'm interested in learning from communities now is just, has this changed anything for them? And how has it changed their approaches and their interests in language? And so I would like to, you know, meet them there and just understand what those needs are.
Yeah, so you can overcome them and provide resources that kind of fit what the needs are now,
yes,
given the changing circumstances. You know, I want to get into something that you brought very briefly, and this is a part of your organization as well, because, you know, just recently there's been little dispute, obviously, that Indigenous languages are endangered, but there is some debate over how these languages should be preserved and who should be leading this charge, you know, and whether that should be, you know, organizations or people who aren't really associated with a tribe. And there was an issue that came up. This was not in California, but it was a language conservancy organization was banned from the Standing Rock Reservation after the tribe claimed that the group copyrighted their languages and tried to sell their language and their educational materials back to them. I mean, is this a larger conversation that you're having in terms of who should be leading this charge, and if you know, and essentially who should participate and also potentially profit from this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is part of a larger conversation, and I'm learning more about it too. And especially when it comes to things like intellectual property law, and especially as we start looking at stuff like archiving language, and what we're offering to community researchers is the access to the archives, and things in there are for public access, and issues do arise about whether things in there should be public access. Communities, we often have these protocols around certain traditional things, like songs that can only be sung during certain times, or prayers that can only be said during certain times. And I think when someone's trying to get into researching a community, their culture, their language, and working with them, it's important to have some tribal approval before you get into it. Talking with that community, get to understand what those protocols are, what makes the most sense, what their wishes are. And we as an organization, we don't own or resell anything that comes out of the work that we're doing, because we're not documenting languages for the communities. We're trying to empower them to do it themselves. But we do advocate for people that when they are working with a linguist or any other researcher, to find out what they're all about and what's their intent. It's too often in our history we've had people that just mine that information and then take it away. And then we only see it in an archive, if we see it at all. So there has to be some reciprocity. There has to be some giving back, some contribution back to the community. And it's really helpful if you can find somebody that you trust and continue to work with them. And we have seen that in our work, where folks connect with somebody that they trust, they like working with them, that person becomes a part of the community, and the work that they're doing goes back to the community. And I think those are some of the better situations that we've encountered. And we've also encountered things where it doesn't really work out. But what helps is, I think, just doing your due diligence. My hope in being a leader with this organization is we can be part of that shift from mining of language to something more based in collaboration and reciprocity. Communities that are working together with academics and the people that run language nonprofits and businesses, whether native or not, and who are all involved in the reclamation or maintenance documentation of that language, to hopefully where they can reach an end that's respectful of the community's wishes and protocols. And so, you know, people sometimes ask us, what do you do? And so I just think, ask a lot of questions, find out what their intent is, their methods, their values, and find out if they align with yours and what you want to get out of that project. It all starts with what you intend to do with that work, and determine from the start, who is it for? Who do you want to see it? How do you want them to access it? If you're putting it into an archive, find out whether that archive is friendly to your community's needs, or if they're going to gatekeep you from your own language materials. And I think just like any business, even if it's a nonprofit, they have every right to walk away and not use their services, and find someone who's more accommodating to what your community wants.
Carly, thank you so much for joining us and sharing about your organization.
You're welcome.
Carly,
happy to be here.
Yep, happy to have you. We learned a lot. Carly Tex is the executive director of the Advocates for Indigenous California Indigenous Language Survival, sharing how they are working to save Native American languages in California for future generations. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.